Hello, my name is Cheryl Cohen, and I'm the president of Arthritis Consumer Experts, or ACE. ACE provides education and training to people with arthritis. We also help to empower people living with all forms of arthritis to take control of their disease and to take action in healthcare and research decision making. I'm also a person living with rheumatoid arthritis. If you're listening at your computer, this month we're including some written materials that go along with this podcast. We're here today with Dr. Kam Shojanya, who has joined us before, and we're really pleased to have him back. Dr. Shojanya is a leader in the field of rheumatology. His research specialty is the efficacy of different medications on the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, and psoriatic arthritis. So welcome, Dr. Shojanya.
Thank you.
Today's Joint Health Podcast is intended as a primer for listeners wanting to know more about how to get started on the best treatment path for their rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, or psoriatic arthritis. So a very important topic, as you can imagine, Dr. Shojanya, for those people who are either still trying to figure out what the heck's going on with their body. They know they're suffering from severe, moderate to severe inflammation. They know their lives are changing before their very eyes, but they don't yet have a confirmed diagnosis. And we hope this information will help them get there. Also for the person who's newly or recently diagnosed and still sort of searching around the edges, really, of the diagnosis and not yet really understanding fully what the disease is. And also, though, for the person who's been living with it for some time. So that's sort of the crux of the discussion today. And without sort of further delay, I think we'd like to jump right into it. So I guess one of the very first questions we want to ask you is, why is it challenging to get diagnosed with one of these three diseases?
I think that when someone with symptoms of one of these diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, or psoriatic arthritis, when that person reads the symptoms and signs, they usually are right when they can self-diagnose almost. The challenge is actually learning about them because most people don't know about them. Also, they might think they're too young because they think it's an older person's disease, but it can happen at any age, frequently young people. So that one of the first places to look is that they can read up on these conditions themselves.
Yeah.
And I know that on your website you have some sites that they can read up on them. But if you would like to speak about rheumatoid arthritis sort of in particular, that remember that it's an inflammatory condition that affects many tissues in the body. The joints are most severely affected, but again, it affects the general blood, the system, how the fatigue levels, stiffness, also other organs, which we can talk about later if we have time.
Mm-hmm.
Once those the stiffness in the morning, the multiple joint inflammation, the weakness sets in, you really need to get in to see a specialist as soon as possible. The rheumatologist, I think, is the most best person to see, there is an urgency to it.
Yeah.
So this is not let's wait for a few months and see what happens symptom. This might be rheumatoid. The primary care doctor should be saying this might be rheumatoid arthritis. We better get you in right away to get that ruled out. Because if it isn't, then we can do other things. If it is, you need to get on treatment right away.
Right. Lots of people, Dr. Shojanya, come to our workshops and having been diagnosed, but they tell of the struggle they had actually convincing their family physician. So it appears to be a challenge. I know it's one that you and your colleagues at the Canadian Rheumatology Association are really trying to work hard on improving in that area. The communication between the family doctor, their awareness of what these primary sort of hallmark signs and symptoms are of inflammatory arthritis, such as rheumatoid arthritis, and then encouraging them to refer these people to you quickly. So I think at ACE, what we've really worked hard at doing is arming the person with the complaint with the right words, with the right information to push their family physician, frankly speaking, to refer. So is it persistent swelling, what are the thing, what are the words patients should use with their family care provider to get pushed through the referral system?
I think swollen joints.
Yep.
Weakness in the joint, loss of function. Tell the doctor what you cannot do. I cannot open the car door. I cannot turn a key in the ignition. I'm having trouble picking up my child.
It hurts when someone shakes my hand.
Exactly.
Squeezes my hand. Yeah.
And the fact that these are new symptoms. Okay. Generally, if these symptoms have been present since you were 10 years old and you're now 50, it's unlikely that it's going to be rheumatoid at that point. But if these symptoms typically are occurred within the last week or a couple of weeks or a month or two, there is an urgency to it.
And that these symptoms sort of just came out of the blue.
Yes. They can either come out of the blue overnight, they can come out, come up, or they can come on typically insidiously over a few months.
Okay. You've talked a little bit about rheumatoid arthritis, the challenge or some of the signs and symptoms and the challenge of getting diagnosed. I'm guessing the same is true for ankylosing spondylitis and psoriatic arthritis?
Yes. In fact, it might be a bit harder for psoriatic arthritis because the subtypes of psoriatic arthritis typically don't involve many, many joints at the same time. It might involve only one joint, one knee, one ankle, one toe, and then progress. And people typically think, I must have stubbed my toe. I must have twisted my knee, but it's not getting better. So psoriatic arthritis, I think the delay is longer. Similarly with ankylosing spondylitis, which is mainly a back and neck. Back and neck symptoms are the primary symptoms of ankylosing spondylitis, and it's typically young people. It's often ignored because it may be a 19-year-old man who has back pain and stiffness, and it's not expected that a young man or young women have many musculoskeletal problems, so that's why that's ignored. And with ankylosing spondylitis, they can typically play rugby and play tennis, and they're worse when they're at rest, not with activity.
Right.
So that also confuses people into thinking they must be fine, they're still playing rugby. So So that diagnosis is often delayed for 5 or 10 years before it's made.
Okay. So I guess for those groups of people, the key message is, you know, if something is... If you're a 35-year-old male and at rest you have quite severe back pain, that's not normal.
That's not normal. It's not normal to be stiff in the morning in your joints for more than 30 minutes.
Right. Okay. Good. That's a
We're all stiff in the morning for a few minutes.
Right.
But 30 minutes is the cutoff.
30 minutes and then beyond that. Yeah. And also the pairing of being able to, after that period of time, go about your day quite fine.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Terrific. So we've identified some of the key sort of hallmark symptoms of these three types of inflammatory arthritis. I know for myself as a person living with rheumatoid arthritis, one of the challenges I had in navigating sort of the treatment path, which is the focus of our discussion today, was simply agreeing with the rheumatologist and accepting the news that I had rheumatoid arthritis. And I went about all manner of crazy things to convince myself that I didn't. But after a year of chasing a wild cure and bizarre treatment after another, I came to learn, having been bound in a wheelchair by that point, not able to care for myself, that, okay, I better do something about this because this life isn't worth leading the way it is. What can you... tell us, what do you think you can do as a professional in the field of rheumatology to help someone accept their diagnosis?
I think that's a very hard thing to do.
Yeah.
It depends on the person and where they are in their lives and their coping strategies.
Yeah.
If one of their psychological coping strategies is avoidance, then they're going to use that coping strategy for the diagnosis. They'll avoid it. They won't follow up with me. And I don't keep track of people that I tell them, you have rheumatoid, I'll see you in 1 week. We're going to start treatment. And if they don't come in 1 week, you know,
it's a signal.
It's a signal. And I may not have follow up with them.
Yeah.
They may have gone somewhere else. So perhaps, but some people do that. They don't follow up. They might come 8 months later, or they might go see someone else doctor shopping for a better diagnosis.
Right.
So what I think how I can explain it to them or get them to accept it, to show them why I think it is the diagnosis, why I don't think it's other things, give them time to answer questions, and bring them back with family members. Because I think if I can get the family on side, the spouse, the kids, or the parents, then they will accept it more.
Yeah.
Often I find I'm fighting against other people in their lives who think it's something else, and if I get everyone on side, it's easier.
Boy, I think that highlights a really key point. I know that in the February issue of Joint Health Monthly, we talk about the need for family support, or pardon me, the January issue of Joint Health Monthly, we talk about the importance of family support in moving forward on a really positive sort of path, including a treatment path, and helping to get that person who's been diagnosed with what can be very devastating disease sort of at least emotionally supported. And then when one feels emotionally supported, then they can move forward and feel comfortable making quite difficult decisions about treatment. So it's good to hear that your thinking is certainly right along the lines of that of Dr. Alan Lehman, who's a real leader in that area of research. So once you work with your patients to accept the diagnosis, I gather it's really important to bring them along and help them to learn about some of the treatment options that you're going to talk about. Can you share with us sort of how you go about doing that? What is important from your perspective for patients to learn about to prepare for making choices about treatment?
I find it the people that I know are going to do well, no matter what, are the ones that take control of the process from here. They will go and do some of their own reading. They'll find out some information. Whether it's correct or not, it doesn't really matter at this point. They'll bring it back to me and we'll discuss it. We'll go through the tests. And by the way, the tests are not very specific in diagnosing rheumatoid arthritis. Some of the listeners may think that they have rheumatoid arthritis based on a rheumatoid factor, which is not correct. Okay. That doesn't have to be that. It's not a very helpful test at the diagnosis point. But those people do well when they are bringing back information. How I lay out the information is mainly I go through the urgency about treatment. I look at I'm mainly optimistic because I know that if I've caught them early at this point, I can do a lot in treating this and giving them almost a normal life. I provide a note of urgency but optimism. I think at that point. And I divide the treatment into treatment that makes them feel better initially and treatment that prevents damage.
So sort of symptom medications.
Medications and then management medications.
Right. And I'm assuming as well as overviewing for them early on the need for urgent sort of action.
Yes.
On both of your parts as physician and as patient. But also a clear description, it sounds like, of the different kinds of medications, and as well other things they can be doing to treat the whole person, like physical rehabilitation or exercise, taking a look at the other aspects of their life, such as their work, how are they accommodated at work, or whether they're even thinking about getting work accommodations, such as an appropriate physical work environment for them, maybe shifted hours, maybe shared work. And I think patients, when we're sitting in your office, we forget about all of the other stuff that's quite important along with the medication.
I think you're absolutely right. The most important thing to do at the beginning is impress upon people the need for a very healthy lifestyle. And the first and foremost is quitting smoking. If they quit smoking at that initial time, it's my belief that a lot of people will develop an improvement in their inflammatory symptoms. We know it's related to smoking, and we don't have time to discuss the research about smoking and rheumatoid arthritis, but there's a high correlation between the two. So they have to stop smoking. Diet is important. There's a couple of good studies looking at reduced meat and dairy in the diet and increased fish.
Right.
And stress and work. appropriate rest periods during the day, especially at the beginning, and exercise. So those are all very important.
So when you say especially in the beginning, you mean when the disease first sort of hits.
And is active and they're fatigued.
Yeah. Okay. That makes lots of sense. I think what we want to maybe try to do at this point in our discussion, Dr. Shojanya, is let's talk about, I know that your time in your office with a person is limited, like it is for any physician. And because one of the things that you do that you're very expert at doing, you need to spend a lot of time in the clinic talking to them about medication choices, options, choices, monitoring, and all of those kinds of points of discussion. So let's sort of zero in on that now. And in terms of the navigating the treatment path, talk about what you would lay out in the way of options, first starting with those symptom management kinds of medications that you alluded to a few minutes ago, and then moving on to the types of medications that actually treat the underlying disease.
I think just before I do that, well, you talked about managing that time in the office, speaking to patients. Yeah. I think the patient could better manage that time. I think you rewrote about this in your book, Rheumatoid Arthritis Plan to Win, that you co-wrote with Dr. John Esdale and Tasha Palmer, about managing the time in the office and also about these medications. So I would direct the listener to perhaps look up that book. Yeah. It's a very good handbook for people with rheumatoid arthritis.
Thanks. Quickly, before you move on, I'll just remind listeners who haven't seen it or who haven't attended an ACE workshop, we really encourage folks to be prepared for their appointment, have a list of the medications they're on, both the names, generic and brand name, the dosages, the frequency, as well other over-the-counter things they're taking, and walk into that office with a list, two lists, one you keep, one you leave with the doctor, and your top three things you want to have addressed in that visit. And research has shown that people who come into a doctor's office well prepared are actually more respected as patients than those that don't.
Yes.
So if you're going to want to make an advantage for yourself, that's one way of doing it. So thanks for reminding me of that.
So getting back to the symptom managing medicines. Now, these are the medicines that likely don't change the long-term disease process. That would be the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and we call them NSAIDs, NSAIDs for short. And everyone has been on an NSAID in their lives. Everyone has taken aspirin and ibuprofen for various things, and those are NSAIDs, and those are powerful NSAIDs actually. And the reason those are over the counter are not because they're safer. It's because they're over the counter and they're older, and people have decided that they can take them. I think if aspirin and ibuprofen came on the market today, brand new, they would not be over the counter. They would be by prescription with lots of warning labels. So anyway, aspirin and ibuprofen are typical NSAIDs. Other ones that people might hear about include naproxen or naprosyn, diclofenac, also sometimes called Voltaren, or Arthrotec in that combination medicine, indomethacin or Indocid. And then there's another type of anti-inflammatory or NSAID, and we call them COXIBs or selective NSAIDs. Those are medications such as Celecoxib or Celebrex, and now Lumiricoxib or Prexige is another new selective NSAID. These are also called COX-2 inhibitors. If you remember, there was a Vioxx, which was taken off the market because of increased cardiovascular risks, and Bextra, which was another COXIB that was taken off not for heart risks but for rash. That was rash. That's right. Why it was taken off. Mm-hmm. So, and just to make a long story short about these medications, they do not slow down the progression of rheumatoid arthritis, but they do work quickly. So if you have a lot of joint pain and stiffness and you take an NSAID, they should start to work within a few days to a week in reducing pain symptoms. So I do use NSAIDs, but my goal is not to just relieve symptoms. And I think that if people with rheumatoid arthritis have to rely on NSAIDs or coccyx to control their symptoms, then I don't think their disease is controlled.
Right. Okay, so that's a really important key message. The NSAIDs are important to help deal with early on the symptoms of inflammation and pain early on, but are not addressing the underlying disease that sort of is moving forward if left untreated.
That's correct.
Right.
And remember, side effects of NSAIDs are often under appreciated.
Yeah.
And they include bleeding stomach ulcers, mm-hmm. Also other types of ulcers throughout the gastrointestinal tract. Mm-hmm. And more recently, it's come to light that all NSAIDs or anti-inflammatories have an increased cardiovascular risk.
Right. So
all
if,
of them.
So if they're going to be used, then they need to be used carefully, and the person who's going to take them needs to be fully informed about not just the benefits, but also the risks. But I think clearly, if we look at certainly our community membership, there is a strong sort of need for this class of medications, these symptom type medications, because some people live with quite horrific inflammation.
That's true. And also, there's another exception to that rule about if they only must take an anti-inflammatory. Some people with well-controlled rheumatoid arthritis that have damage in the joints that's not inflammation, they sometimes need their anti-inflammatory.
Right.
And they can take that on an as-needed basis often.
Good. So that really, I think, is a really nice synopsis. I know there's one other kind of medication that I know there's some debate about whether it treats underlying disease or whether it is just a symptom-treating drug, and that's steroids or corticosteroids.
Yes.
So maybe you could touch on that.
So that group of medications, as you said, they're called steroids for short. Sometimes they're called corticosteroids. I think maybe the most appropriate scientific name would be glucocorticoids.
Okay.
You might hear that name.
Yeah.
Typical one is prednisone, or in Europe they sometimes use prednisolone. You can have it. The nice thing about the steroids are that they work extremely rapidly, and they work very well. They at the right dose, they will eliminate symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. And we use them at very high doses when the rheumatoid arthritis is affecting organs such as the eye, the lungs, vasculitis, or the blood vessels. So we do use them, and they are life-saving and organ-saving medications. However, long-term use of the glucocorticoids, such as prednisone, does increase the mortality and morbidity or illnesses that people use. And long-term, I mean years. Years of use of prednisone is not good. I don't say I never do that, because there's a very rare patient that nothing else works and they always have to take some long-term steroids, but they do that knowing all the potential side effects. And as you said, what I often use them is right at the beginning. While we're waiting for the next group of medications, we'll talk about DMARDs.
Mm-hmm.
While we're waiting for those to have effect, we will use a short course of corticosteroids. And there are some studies to show, as you suggested, there's some debate about this, but there are some studies to show that it does reduce some of the damage early on. And I believe it does. They do.
And is it because they really address and nip in the bud that inflammation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think right at the beginning, they reduce damage. Of course, if someone has had rheumatoid arthritis for 12 years, I don't know if the steroids 12 years later are helping reduce damage.
Okay.
But I believe in the first couple of months or 3 months, they do.
If you're on a short course of prednisone or another one of these glucocorticoids, what should some of the concerns be around side effects? Is there anything we can do to mitigate against those while we're on that prednisone for a short period of time?
Yes, prednisone has short and long-term side effects. Short-term, I can't give you an exhaustive list of the side effects, but short-term side effects would include osteoporosis, even short-term. Osteonecrosis is the one I worry about, but one of the most rare side effects, and that could knock out the end of a bone, the end of a long hip bone, like such as the hip or the knee or the shoulder. You can lose that and have damage in that joint. Now, that's a very rare side effect, but there's no way to watch for it, and when it happens, there's no going back.
Okay.
So that's very rare. The other side effects, I think, that you could help mitigate against is osteoporosis, and that would be taking appropriate calcium, vitamin D, ensuring weight-burning exercise, avoidance of smoking.
And
there are some medicines we use. If we think the person's going to need prednisone more than a few months, then we use typically an osteoporosis medication just for that time period.
Right. I know at our workshops you've spoken before, Dr. Shojanya, that if a person, and I think this is a very helpful guideline for the listener, that if you're on 7.5 milligrams or more of prednisone for longer than 3 months, then that's when you might look at adding one of these other medicines you talk about, which I believe are bisphosphonates.
Bisphosphonates, that's right.
Okay. So just wanted to sort of cover that off quickly so that the folks who are listening who are either on prednisone or perhaps afraid to take it very early on, it's important that we've learned from you that they have a really valuable role short term, but that you don't want to get stuck on these things for a long time. You want to get to this next category that we're talking about, which is the DMARDs, or disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. Maybe you can touch on some of the biggies, so to speak.
So DMARDs, or disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, it's a term that covers a heterogeneous group of medicines, a group of medicines that are very different in the way they work, but they all have the same effect in that they reduce the inflammation and damage in rheumatoid arthritis. Now, they all have another common feature, is that they're relatively slow onset. Some can take a few weeks, and some can take a few months to start, which is why, again, we use the NSAIDs, Coxibs, and prednisone at the beginning. So there are, I think, about 10 DMARDs, and sometimes we classify them as traditional or small molecule DMARDs, like the ones we used before, solely previously, and then the newer ones called biologics, biologic DMARDs. And generally we use the older traditional DMARDs first because we know about them and because of cost.
Yeah.
They are less expensive. Yeah. The most common DMARD used now in rheumatoid arthritis is methotrexate. That's our medicine. That's probably the best first DMARD in rheumatoid arthritis. We know that methotrexate, well, people get scared. They look online and they say, well, that's a cancer drug. Why are you giving me a cancer drug?
Right.
And the dose we use in rheumatoid arthritis is many, many times smaller than the cancer dose. First of all. And second of all, people worry that it may cause cancer or have lots of other side effects. The more we use methotrexate, the safer we realize it is. Mm-hmm. It does not increase the risk of cancer. It does not shorten life expectancy. And in fact, in some studies, it extends life expectancy. In a large study by Fred Wolf in Wichita, it extends life expectancy. And it's our best first drug in rheumatoid arthritis. Other ones we use, and the other thing we've learned is that we should use bigger doses of methotrexate.
Okay.
And we have to ramp the dose up quickly to get control of the disease.
Okay.
It's once a week. It's by pill or by injection.
So what's, in your view, what is an adequate dose of methotrexate for someone who has moderate to severe, or even mild for that matter, active disease? What's the benchmark?
I start at 15 milligrams once a week.
Okay.
And I try to rapidly ramp it up to 25 milligrams once a week.
Okay.
And so my starting dose is 15. And 10 years ago, my starting dose was 7.5.
Okay.
Now I don't try that dose.
Yes, I've read in the research literature that pretty much your colleagues around the world now realize that methotrexate in the past perhaps wasn't as effective, but that was just because and not enough of it was being used.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Also, there's some good evidence that injectable methotrexate, so it's just under the skin like it's an insulin shot, is better absorbed and better tolerated than oral pill methotrexate. So I often switch to the injectable quite quickly.
That's an interesting point. As we both know, the most common side effect with particularly the higher doses of methotrexate in the range of 20 and 25 It's mouth ulcers.
That's right.
So you're suggesting, Dr. Shojania, that by taking it like an insulin shot under the skin, it would bypass that and hopefully prevent some of that?
Prevent some. It should prevent much of the gastrointestinal side effects. So right. The mouth ulcers, the stomach upset that occasionally people will get.
Right.
And it's only once a week, so it's relatively innocuous injection.
Okay.
More often though, what I'm trying to do, if my patient will allow me to, and that's the key barrier for me, is to start something called triple therapy. And my reasoning for this, and that's three DMARDs right at the beginning:
right.
Methotrexate, hydroxychloroquine, and sulfasalazine. And in addition, if they allow me, I'd like to give a short course of prednisone. So that's actually four drugs,
right.
Prednisone plus triple therapy.
Right.
If this triple therapy doesn't achieve excellent control of rheumatoid arthritis in 10 weeks or 12 weeks, mm-hmm. then I know that I need to get onto a biologic DMARD right away.
Right.
And I think that's better than trying methotrexate first, waiting for a while, then adding something and waiting. Pretty soon you could get up to 9 or 10 months or a year before people are controlled, and by that time most of them have joint damage.
Right. I know I now have had disease, rheumatoid arthritis, for 18 years, and I got the disease back when it was, let's try the NSAID, wait a long time. At least from my view, it was a long time, because I saw every day slipping by and I was getting worse and worse and worse, to the point where I could no longer feed myself, look after myself. I was completely incapacitated. And so I think the person today who is diagnosed has a tremendous advantage if, in fact, they can overcome the social stigma of taking medications, and there definitely is one. Somehow you're branded as a wimp or a loser or someone who did something wrong, to their grandma way back when, committed some heinous sin. Well, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what, it's not a personality type that gets any one of these kinds of inflammatory arthritis we're talking about. So for the listeners, I really encourage those folks who are having a tough time sort of coming to grips with the fact that they have to take medication, that, there's just tons of research that shows that is the proper treatment path to try to get on,
mm-hmm.
if they're going to dial the volume down, so to speak, of their symptoms, get control of that disease, and resume as much as possible their normal life, which is what this is all about. I think the other key thing, Dr. Shojania, that's helpful for people that come into contact with our organization and come to our workshops and possibly visit your office, is that rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, psoriatic arthritis, and the other kinds of inflammatory arthritis, they're serious diseases. They are like cancer. They are like HIV. They need a cocktail of drugs, medications, to get control of the disease.
Just to build on that, what you just said, rheumatoid arthritis has the same mortality. Now, this is not mild rheumatoid, but moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis has the same mortality as stage 4 Hodgkin's disease, which is a cancer.
Isn't wow,
it?
Yeah.
So you're right, and you don't see someone telling someone, oh, you've got Hodgkin's disease, I'm going to try a bit of this and see how you do, and then I'm going to try a bit of that.
Yeah, people get on it.
Yeah, they say, we're going to get rid of this disease.
Yes.
And it may come back, but we can deal with it. And that's what we should be doing with rheumatoid arthritis.
Absolutely, and I just am very glad you raised that point, because not only is it important that people who are recently or newly diagnosed with it, not only should they start thinking that way, our physicians have to think that way. It's not enough anymore just to sort of get by. We want cures. We want, whether they're medication-delivered cures or whether they're biological cures where you take one pill and it's gone forever, we as patients do not want to live our lives feeling, recognizing any of this stuff going on in our body. We want it done. We want it dealt with. And it takes that same kind of attitude in cancer therapy, in diabetes treatment, in HIV treatment. No one wants to live with these things. And people with arthritis, and I'm talking broad arthritis, need to start thinking that way too. And our physicians need to support us in that. Yeah. So what other types of treatments in that DMARD character? You've talked about the triple combination. Really, if you feel you've used all of those in combination at their, you know, tolerable or highest doses in people, then it's time to move on.
Yes, I think that if you've used triple therapy, as I indicated, and that didn't work appropriately, which means getting rid of the swelling, bringing down the inflammation in the blood, improving function.
Yeah.
Then it's time to move to a biologic.
Okay. And so let's talk about those. We know that there are now five available. I think you're going to give us really a good snapshot of what each of these are.
So biologic response modifiers are medications used for treating rheumatoid arthritis that interfere with signaling pathways involved in inflammation. Now, this is different than, these drugs are different than the methotrexates and the other medicines we usually use, which generally suppress inflammation throughout a number of mechanisms. These drugs target one area of the inflammation and target that.
And do they also, let me just interject, so when you say rheumatoid arthritis, but also for psoriatic
arthritis,
and ankylosing spondylosis.
Yes,
okay,
sorry.
Good.
Should,
okay. No, that's okay. I'll just remind the listener that these do treat all of them.
Now, well, the anti-TNFs do treat all of them. We're
okay.
Working on the other two, and I'll tell
okay.
you. The drugs in this class include proteins that bind tumor necrosis factor, or TNF. Now, really, this has nothing to do with tumors, but that's just the name of the molecule.
Okay.
That's just how it was described first. So it binds TNF, and those TNF is an important pro-inflammatory, or causes inflammation, signaling molecule. Now, there are three anti-TNF biologics, etanercept, which is also called Enbrel, adalimumab, which is also called Humira, and infliximab, which is also called Remicade. Now, the other biologic used for rheumatoid arthritis, it works differently. That's called Anakinra, mm-hmm. and that's also called Kineret. Now, we don't usually use that one anymore. It just didn't seem to pan out, but I just wanted to provide the name just so people know.
Right,
we do
because
use it
I think
sometimes.
There are some people that are on it, and it
yes.
is effective.
Yes, but. It is effective, and in fact, I use it now for off-label for something called adult Still's disease, which it seems to work very well for that. So,
oh, excellent.
As an aside.
Okay.
Now, there's two new biologics that are not that are approved for rheumatoid arthritis, but not yet for psoriatic arthritis and ankylosing spondylitis. And those two are abatacept, which is also called Arencia, and rituximab, which is called Rituxan as well. Abatacept interferes with activation of one type of T cell, and rituximab depletes or takes out another type of B cell.
Okay, so bad B cells. Apparently.
Yeah, B cells
yeah.
are bad. Yeah.
Okay.
But on the other hand, they are good in a way. So,
yeah.
And by doing that, they also reduce TNF and interleukin-1, which are messengers and made up in large amounts in people with rheumatoid arthritis. Biologic response, all of these biologic response agents, they work very rapidly, usually within 2 weeks in some medications, such as the anti-TNF biologics, and between 4 to 6 weeks for the others, such as the abatacept and rituximab. They can be used alone, but typically what I like to do, and most rheumatologists like to do, is to use them in combination with DMARDs, most specifically methotrexate. They seem to work better with methotrexate than alone.
Is there some research as well that suggests that using methotrexate in combination with one or possibly a couple of these biologics, that they actually reduce the chance of side effects?
There, I think there's good data that using methotrexate, yes, reduces the antibodies you can make to these medicines.
Okay.
And they can improve the effect of the medication.
Okay.
And prolong the effect of the medication.
Okay.
So that's why I like to use methotrexate with all of those medicines when possible. Now, of course, we never use biologics with each other. So we never combine biologics together, just for if people are interested. We don't do that because it's an increased risk of infection when we combine biologics together.
Okay.
But because of the cost of the biologics, it's very difficult to make them. They're proteins. They're not chemicals. The costs are generally more than $20,000 per year in Canada. We try to reserve them for people who have not fully responded to DMARDs. Triple therapy, I think, is a good try.
So if someone fails or achieves a less than enthusiastic response in your view and the patient's view, then it's definitely time to move on.
That's what I think.
The biologics.
Now, there are some studies looking at taking someone with early rheumatoid arthritis and going right to a biologic plus methotrexate right at the beginning and getting people in remission, then stopping the biologic after a year, and even, now I hesitate to say this, but even stopping the methotrexate after that and seeing that a significant percentage, the rheumatoid arthritis doesn't come back.
Wow.
So I think it might be, you know, if you're just supposing that in the future it might be economically better to get rid of rheumatoid arthritis in a certain number of people by doing that. And in the other people, I think you're adjusting the disease, the long-term disease severity downward.
Well, and that also makes economic sense in another way, in that if we can nip through a new way of thinking about how treatment is initiated early on in the disease, if we can nip that in the bud, people stay normal. You know, they keep working, they keep caring for their family, and they don't go on short and long-term disability, which, as we know, is a key driver in the cost of these kinds of diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, and psoriatic arthritis. In other words, we have to convince government that paying for them early makes good financial sense, because they're not going to be on their paycheck in the long-term disability lineup for the rest of their life if we switch our approach.
It's funny that government often likes that idea, but the provincial payer for the drug doesn't like it, because they don't see the benefit of people working. They just see the drug cost. So they just try to keep drug costs down without an overall look at people working in economic.
So if we have anyone from government listening, we should remind them.
Think of the big
that
picture.
They need to go to the finance minister and say, hey, we need a credit back from the disability column, because the stuff we're doing, the money we're spending in our pharmacare budgets, for example, is saving you other characters money.
It's interesting when I talk to private insurance companies about this, and they care about disability because it costs a lot to them.
Yeah.
They will pay for the drug to prevent further disability.
So again, I guess to our government listeners, you've got to start looking at innovating the way policy is made around reimbursement for these things.
I should just mention maybe about the biologic response modifiers. They're all injectable. They're
okay,
no
so
pills.
Can you just very quickly, in that list of five, just tell us how they're administered?
Okay.
And add any other detail you might think helpful to the listener.
So remember I talked about three anti-TNF biologics that are available: etanercept and adalimumab, or Enbrel and Humira. Those are administered under the skin, just like methotrexate or insulin, and that's once a week for Enbrel and once every 2 weeks for Humira. Infliximab or Remicade is administered intravenously, usually at the beginning, more frequently at week zero, then 2 weeks later, then 6 weeks later, then every 8 weeks, but sometimes every 6 weeks, depending on the person.
Okay.
And that's intravenously and takes several hours to go in. Now, the choice of the biologic depends, I think, on the individual. If you like to travel on vacation for 3 weeks at a time, perhaps Remicade is the one for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you live far away from somewhere where you can get the infusion, perhaps one of the other ones, the Enbrel or Humira, is the one for you. I think that's a patient and physician choice.
Absolutely, and I think the key is to make these all available, lay out the choices, which is a key part of navigating the treatment path, really the subject of today's podcast.
And the other two, Orencia and Rituxan, are both given intravenously.
Okay.
Orencia is given intravenously monthly. It takes about 30 minutes, and I usually do this at home.
Oh, wow.
So at the patient's home, a nurse comes by and gives them the intravenous. And rituximab, it's done quite differently. That's given by two infusions, 2 weeks apart, takes a few hours, and has to be done in a center. But after that, you just wait. You know, the disease goes away. In lots of people, and then you wait till it comes back, then you get a retreatment. And that might be 6 months later or 9 months later. It could be as short as 4 months later. So we don't know.
Wow.
So
lots of different options.
Yes.
One might appeal to one person and their physician much more so than another. But it's the choice, I think, that so underscores this whole class, actually, of medications. And the same would be true of DMARDs as well, whether one takes methotrexate orally or by injection, completely the choice of the patient and the physician.
That's right.
Yeah, that's terrific. One of the things that come up as we near the end of our discussion today, Dr. Shojania, one of the things I think that so important for people to understand if they're living with one of these three types of inflammatory arthritis, and that's, you know, while we all fear having to take a medication and certainly to take it for a long time as we're told to do, and as we have to reach agreement to do to get better, you know, we're afraid of what happens when one takes them for a long time. And so I think that something that we really strongly promote and message about at our workshops and our newsletters is that you can try to manage that fear by getting your regular monitoring. And maybe you can talk to us about monitoring and what it does in terms of allaying both your concerns as a physician, I'm sure, but also the fear of the patient.
I think I was listening to you talk about fear, and I realized fear is the biggest challenge I have to overcome in my patients. Fear of the diagnosis, which fear of the medicines, fear of getting back to work, fear of exercise. You know, everyone's different, but I think fear is their biggest limiting factor, not the disease, actually. I think it's fear.
My biggest fear early on was that I'd end up in a wheelchair. And interestingly, that is what happened, and only because my fear paralyzed
me. That's right.
From making a decision to actually get treatment.
And I tell people that not making a decision is actually a decision too.
Yeah.
Fear of the medications, it's interesting. I wish a psychologist could help me with this, because the people that most fear the medications at the beginning, after I get them on it, they're the ones that don't do the blood tests and follow up.
Oh,
more likely.
Yeah.
So you'd think that they would be more afraid and be regular, but I think it wasn't the fear of the medicine. It was not accepting the disease in the first place.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm not as afraid of these medicines as, for example, the DMARDs or the biologics, as I am afraid of anti-inflammatories. Because anti-inflammatories, we can't monitor for side effects. You know, once if you have a bleeding stomach ulcer, you have it. You know, there's nothing you couldn't have avoided it.
Yeah.
You couldn't have prevented it. But with these other medicines, the DMARDs and the biologics, we monitor for any problems. We monitor liver enzymes. We monitor the blood counts. We monitor people for infections. And these are rare side effects. So as long as people are aware of the potential side effects and they just have the occasional blood test or TB skin test, for example, that we arrange, and that could be every month to 3 months, blood tests, then most of the side effects are being watched, and we can see the change in the blood test before any damage is done.
Okay. So side effects, let's say someone has a side effect, it's addressed, do they usually resolve? Do they go away?
The vast majority go away. So if, for example, someone is taking methotrexate and I notice the liver tests start to become abnormal, well, they wouldn't feel anything. I would just call them and ask them about what's been happening in their lives. And I may adjust the methotrexate dose or stop it, and the liver tests will come back to normal. They wouldn't. So most of the side effects are reversible.
And then would you restart the therapy?
I typically would restart.
And then you'd check it again?
Check it again.
Okay.
And surprisingly, most of the time it's fine.
So it's just an abnormality
yes.
in the
It could
test.
Have been a virus, or they could have perhaps had a couple more martinis than they usually do or something. But it's not, typically it's not the medicine.
Yeah. Let's talk very quickly, in that you raised it, about alcohol use. And particularly methotrexate, but I guess in general with any medication. We know, because I'm a person living with the disease, and when we go out and we talk to people and we have our evidence-based workshops, you know, people sort of come up to me at the break and they say, now, you know, I won't take methotrexate actually because I don't want to give up my glass of wine with dinner.
Yes.
But I mean, that has a cost to them as well, obviously, because they're not taking a medication that is proved to be very effective in treating these diseases, or at least rheumatoid arthritis. How do you deal with that?
I let them have their glass of wine with dinner.
Okay.
And I try not to, I tell them not to binge. I try to, you know, they shouldn't drink, you know. I think one or two drinks, one, and I think a man made this rule, but one drink a day for a woman and two drinks a day for a man maximum. That's what I hear. But there's no evidence behind that. There's no evidence, good evidence, that drinking is detrimental to methotrexate or increases side effects of methotrexate.
Yes, I understand that the rheumatology community generally started this practice of no drinking with when you're on methotrexate based on a study in psoriatic arthritis.
That's right.
And methotrexate.
Yes. And people with psoriasis, for some reason, have more liver fibrosis.
Okay.
Anyway, with or without alcohol, people with psoriasis, in some studies, drink more alcohol for some reason. So the cause effect is not really clear. But for people with rheumatoid arthritis, I let them drink. I suggest no binge drinking. And we're monitoring the liver enzymes anyway. So if there's going to be a problem, we would see.
Okay. You obviously know that not all of your colleagues across the country agree with that. But I think the vast majority that we have spoken to are moving towards, you know, one or two drinks a week, wine, trying to avoid spirits.
Yes,
anything distilled.
Yeah,
which makes sense. And you know that good old adage: all good things in moderation, and maybe more moderation, perhaps, with alcohol and methotrexate for sure. But if you should, as a listener, have any questions about alcohol use and methotrexate, again, we encourage you to speak to your own physician about this. But if you're not taking it because of that, you definitely should speak to them, because methotrexate is a real staple in the treatment of especially rheumatoid arthritis. Let's close this discussion by talking about how you and your patients go about adjusting one's treatment path along the way, because we know that treatments stop working.
Yes.
We don't maybe know why, but it seems that the body develops some way of saying, okay, I'm done with you, drug.
There's two dilemmas that I face. The first dilemma is quite a nice one, actually. The people who have rheumatoid arthritis, we treat aggressively. At 2 years later, they're doing so well that I start disbelieving that they have rheumatoid arthritis. I always go back in my notes and saying, well, hang on a sec, let me just check. How bad was this? You know, and I see that there was definite inflammation in a number of ways. So then the dilemma, they want to stop the medications, and I'm keen on stopping too. But
you don't want to fix what ain't broke.
Yes.
Yeah.
Generally, that's, I think, a mistake, because the times that I've done that, most of the time, it comes back. And when it comes back, it's harder to treat.
In what way? That the same medicines don't work anymore?
Yes.
Or work
yes.
less well?
The same medicine may not have that great a response.
Okay.
So what I do in that case is that I very gradually reduce the medicine, very gradually. Perhaps if it's methotrexate, one tablet. If they're taking 8 pills a week, they might go to 7 pills a week, wait a few months, then reduce it a bit more and follow them very closely. So that's one dilemma. The other dilemma is they were doing well and the medicine doesn't work as well, or is losing effect. In that case, we increase the dose. If that doesn't work, I may review how they're taking it. If it's a biologic, for example, maybe they're keeping it warm, or the pharmacy, it was thawed too early. Remember, those have to be kept cold.
Right.
So there may be a process problem somewhere along the way.
Okay.
And if that's not the case, then the medication does lose effect. And most of them have a chance of losing effect.
Okay.
And if that's the case, we simply change to another medication. We will rotate.
So then just keeping open about this and discussing it and having the regular visits with you and saying, okay, where are we at?
Yes.
Are you feeling better, the same? Are you less well? And in what ways? That's all really important information for us to bring to you as
That's
patients
right.
into your clinic.
I will do now what I do is I do something called a DAS-28, which measures tender joints, swollen joints, sed rate, and inflammation levels, and how the patient is feeling. And if they stay in remission, then I'm quite happy.
Okay, that's terrific. Closing up, I just I want to touch on living life. I mean, people have, when you get a diagnosis of a disease like rheumatoid arthritis or ankylosing spondylitis or psoriatic arthritis, speaking for myself anyway, you instantly are different than everybody else, or at least everybody else without the disease you have. About 1 in 100 people have rheumatoid arthritis, so it's interestingly a bit more common than I think people believe. What's your advice to people who are living with these diseases, Dr. Shojanya? How do they just get on with it?
I wish I could give people advice that will change their lives, but most of the time, if it's their own innate sort of happiness measurement is the important. If they're optimistic, they're going to do well.
Really?
Yeah, in many studies with very different diseases, if you're an optimistic person, you will do better than a pessimistic person. Cancer, arthritis. So they're optimistic. They assume they're going to get better and they're going to back to their lives, and they do. And most of my patients are back to their regular lives for the most part.
Really?
It's the minority that have terrible disease that affects them, that makes them lose out on big parts of their life. They should be able to have children. They should be able to be parents. They should be able to work. You know, they should be able to engage in sports. So
basically define their life and live it.
Yeah, the way they want.
Yeah.
And in fact, my favorite patients are the one that I tell them, I don't think you should be running that marathon. And they do anyway, you know, because they say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Or the guy that said, I need a note for work. And I said, oh, yeah, I don't think you should work. And he said, no, I need a note to tell him I can work, you know, because that's more common than people not wanting to do things.
And I guess that's changed over the years because there is a treatment path to navigate that delivers a really positive outcome today, whereas 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I mean, the best you could offer people was a choice of a handful of NSAIDs and possibly gold, which took, you know, a long time and certainly wasn't a panacea as a treatment. Good in some.
Yeah, still good in some.
Still good in some. But now that picture has changed dramatically.
Yeah, I think before it was almost palliative care. That's what I was thinking about, how it was at that point.
Amazing. Well, that's just a terrific and positive note to end on today, Dr. Shojanya. We're very thankful that you were able to come in and visit with us again and share your huge depth of knowledge on the topic of navigating the treatment path in inflammatory arthritis. We hope that you'll join us again.
Be delighted.
And thanks to you, our Joint Health Podcast audience, for listening. As with all of ACE's programs and services, please keep in mind that the information provided in Joint Health Podcast is not medical advice, and ACE does not brand or promote any product or company. The information provided is to help you better understand arthritis and help you talk to your own rheumatologist or healthcare provider to make the best treatment decisions for yourself. Again, thank you for listening.